If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or your computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, writer, law professor, and filmmaker Joel Bakken on his new documentary, The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. That's coming up on Endeavors.
You're listening to Endeavors Radio with your host from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, Dan McPeak.
Well, hello, everybody, and happy Monday. I've been doing a lot of documentaries recently, and today is no exception. Back in 2003, there was a great documentary called The Corporation, which was directed by Mark Akbar and Jennifer Abbott, which examined the modern-day corporation. The film addresses such topics as the business plot, the tragedy of the commons, suppression of an investigative news story about bovine growth hormone, the invention of the soft drink Fanta, and the privatization of municipal water supply in Bolivia, as well as corporate social responsibility and the debate about corporate personhood. The film won over 25 international awards and had featured interviews with such people as Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, Michael Moore, and Howard Zinn. The film was based on a book called The Corporation, The Pathological Pursuit of Profit and Power, which was written by university law professor Joel Bakken, who also co-wrote the film. That was 17 years ago, in 2003. And now, 17 years later, there is a sequel to that called The New Corporation, The Unfortunately Necessary Sequel. And Bakken, again, writes the film, but this time he also got to co-direct it with Jennifer Abbott, one of the original directors of the first film. In addition to now being a filmmaker, for years, Joel has been a law professor at the Peter A. Allard School of Law at the University of British Columbia, and has been educated at Simon Fraser University, University of Oxford, Dalhousie, and Harvard. So that's a pretty great list of places to be educated at. In 2011, he also authored another book called Childhood Under Siege, and has written a number of books on Canadian constitutional law, including Just Words, Constitutional Rights, and Social Wrongs. If that wasn't enough, he also released a jazz album in 2008 with his second wife, the jazz musician Rebecca Jenkins, called Blue Skies. an album of Jenkins' original songs in 2012 called Something's Coming, and in 2014, Rebecca Jenkins live at The Cellar. The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel, was released a couple of weeks ago, and I got to speak with Joel Bakken earlier today. Here's our conversation. Joel Bakken, hello. Good morning. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. So you have a new film out, The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel. And you co-wrote the first one, but you actually get to co-direct this one. As someone who, you know, never set out to be a filmmaker necessarily, what was that experience like?
It was great. I mean, the thing about directing a film, and I was also a writer on this project as I was on the first, and like the first, it was also based on a book that I was writing while I was making the film. So it's all really storytelling. It's all about trying to convey certain points, a certain argument, a point of view, telling stories. And film is definitely a very different medium than print, but the basic elements of making a point, of telling a story, are really the same across all these different genres. And I had very close experience in the first film. I was involved in the interviews, all aspects of making it. So I did have some experience to rely upon. And I was really fortunate to work with Jennifer Abbott, who's an experienced and brilliant director. So, and a great editor, Peter Roach. And so, you know, we had a great team, and when I fell, people helped pull me up.
You call this the unfortunately necessary sequel. Why do you think it was necessary when we looked about what has happened in capitalism from 2003 and until now?
Yeah, I mean, the idea to do this project really came to me when I was watching the first film at a 10th anniversary kind of celebration of it. And about halfway through the film, I thought, why are we celebrating here? All of the things that we dealt with in the first film have only gotten worse. Climate change is worse. Democracy is more in crisis. Corporations are bigger. They're more powerful than they were before. Governments are more diminished in terms of their ability to regulate them. And at the same time, corporations were saying, hey, we're the good guys now. We're sustainable. We're socially responsible. We can help solve the world's problems. We're no longer causing them. And so I thought, this is really a weird place that the world is in. And big tech, you know, didn't exist when we made the first film, and now it's huge and impactful. So I really thought the world has changed, not just sort of in terms of intensifying things that had been going on, but qualitatively, things were different, and it was really necessary to have another look at that.
Let's talk about that, about this idea that sort of the new image that corporations are painting themselves, because, you know, whenever I see, you know, corporations like marching in pride parades, for example, or, you know, saying these are all sustainable practices, a lot of it strikes me as virtue signaling, and that there's no real accountability for them making sure that they follow through on their promises. Where are you on that?
Yeah, I mean, that is the central point of the book and film. The subtitle of the book is How Good Corporations Are Bad for Democracy. And it seems counterintuitive, because when you look at this kind of virtue signaling, you know, one thing you can say is, well, they're talking a better game than what they're doing, but they still are doing some things, and that's not a bad thing. Why should we come down on them? You know, why? It may not be perfect, but it's better than nothing. And I think that's a fairly common response. And my answer to that response, and the film's answer to that response, is it may actually be worse than nothing, because what's happening through that virtue signaling is they're justifying the fact that they're justifying their demands to be deregulated, to privatize more, to have fewer tax burdens. They're saying we're good now, so we can do a lot of the things that governments used to do. We're good now, so we can run your schools and your water systems. We're good now, so we can regulate ourselves. We don't need to be regulated by government. We're good now, so let us take care of housing and education and health and all of that, and don't tax us anymore to publicly provide those things, but we will provide them in the marketplace. And so there's an equation that often isn't, a connection that often isn't made, that the virtue signaling is not just about saying, hey, we're gonna do more recycling, or we're gonna march in a pride parade, or we're gonna, you know, support Black Lives Matter. But there's a subtext, which is, and because we're now good and responsible and all of that, we can take over from government and we can be freed from government constraints. And that is a problem, in my view, and it's a problem for democracy.
Another issue that I've noticed, and I think Naomi Klein actually has talked about it a lot, is this idea of disaster capitalism. You know, so when the earthquake in Haiti came in, you know, a lot of corporations were there to help with the cleanup, or, you know, Hurricane Sandy, for example. And is that a good thing, or does it strike you as even predatory that, you know, because, oh, these people have nothing, so let's just go in, you know, we'll give them jobs, but we now run this town?
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with Naomi's basic analysis in disaster capitalism. I think what has to be said, and what she does say, and what we say in this project, is that part of the reason why government is incapable of dealing with the disasters, and why companies have to come in, for example, to take over the entire public school system in New Orleans, because government is incapable of replenishing and remaking that system in the wake of Katrina. One of the reasons for that is corporations and big business have been so successful in pushing back taxation and in effectively gutting public revenues to the point where public institutions can't provide the things that we expect them to and that they used to. So it's often referred to as starve the beast, that you starve government of revenue and it can no longer do the things that governments are supposed to do in terms of promoting public interest. And then corporations swoop in, you know, like, you know, on their horses, like they're knights, and say, hey, you know, we'll solve that problem now. And by the way, we're going to do it on a for-profit basis. And the problem isn't only when we have the wake of natural disasters like Katrina. The problem is our own created disasters, like poverty, like lack of housing in inner cities in the United States, like lack of potable drinking water on indigenous reserves in Canada. That these are not natural problems. These are problems because government has neglected to deal with these issues, whether it's providing water or schools or housing or whatever. And a large part of the reason for that is because they've been pushed out of those spaces and they've been pushed out of the revenue they need to occupy those spaces through intense corporate lobbying over the last 40 years. So it's this weird cycle, which we look at in the film, where corporations basically make governments unable to deal with problems. Disasters result from that. And then they swoop in and say, okay, well, we'll save the day. And we're going to, you know, make a 15% profit margin while doing that.
Speaking of disasters, how do you think the pandemic has impacted the way, you know, in which we talk about corporations and capitalism? You know, we saw companies like Loblaw, for example, initially give a pandemic pay, and then they sort of brought that back after 2 months. And now we're seeing a lot of the big box stores get to stay open, but a lot of small businesses I'm being forced to close. How do you think COVID is changing that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what is happening now in the sort of COVID/capitalism space is we're seeing a lot of the same dynamics that we criticize in the film manifesting themselves. We're seeing, you know, big companies like Amazon just expanding their staff and expanding their profits like crazy for obvious reasons during a pandemic, but at the same time, not providing sufficient protection or wages to workers, at the same time, not paying their fair share of taxes. We're seeing companies like Loblaws, promoting, oh, we're going to provide this emergency pay. But, you know, even now when the pandemic is worse than it was when that program was initiated, they're scaling it back because they just, you know, it's now eroding their profits. And their profits, by the way, are just escalating during the pandemic. People are eating out less, they're going to grocery stores more, and so on. So we're seeing those dynamics happening. We're also seeing, especially in the United States, the absolute paralysis in the face of a public health crisis in terms of inability to deal with it, because big business has been so successful over the years in ensuring that the health system isn't put into public hands, that it continues to be in private hands. And I think, you know, when you compare, it's not like things are perfect in Canada, but the abject disaster that's happening in the United States is in large part because of the lack of a public health infrastructure and a public social infrastructure. So we see all those things and we look at them in the film, but there's another side, and that is that a lot of these sort of warts in corporate capitalism are becoming manifest. They're becoming visible. The idea that we don't need government to help us, an idea that's been cultivated for 40 years, just looks silly in the wake of a disaster like this, especially when you compare a country like Canada, and which has had a government-led response, to a country like the United States, where you've had a corporate-led response. So I do think that there are some good things coming out of the pandemic in terms of public awareness, and also in terms of a sense of mutual aid, a sense that, you know, the pandemic really shows that we're not isolated islands as individuals. We're all interconnected with one another in terms of how we get sick, and also in terms of how we get well and how we need to care for each other.
I think another aspect that was talked about a lot, at least when it first hit, was this idea of minimum wage and, you know, whether we should have, whether there should be a federally mandated minimum wage of, I think it was, you know, $15 an hour. And, you know, a lot of businesses were opposed to that. Given where we are, is that a good idea? And do you see any movement on that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we document in the film and in the book, the 15, you know, minimum wage movement in the United States. And I don't think it's any secret that our sort of editorial position on that in the film is, this is a good thing. This is an important movement. You should not be impoverished in our society if you are working 8 hours a day, or if you're working 4 hours a day and taking care of family in the other four, or if you're not working. You should simply not be impoverished in our society. And instead, we have a society where many, many people are barely scraping by, barely making ends meet, barely surviving, let alone flourishing, because we have such an unequal distribution of income and wealth, and a tax system that's skewed towards helping the wealthy and helping the corporate sector. And that's just wrong. The $15 minimum wage, or whatever minimum wage we have, whether it's mandated by provinces or cities or the federal government, is a good idea because it challenges that notion. It says we need to live, and I'm not sure $15 is enough anymore, but it says that, you know, if you have a job, you should not be barely scraping by to survive. And I think that it implies a more general notion that we as a society should be taking care of each other in a way that we're not falling through the cracks, usually almost inordinately through no faults of our own, but because we became ill, because our kids need to be taken care of, because we have an elderly parent who we're looking after, because our landlord has decided to sell the place that we live so that condos can be built. I mean, we need to have a society where we take care of each other and where collectively we take care of each other as individuals. And I think the minimum wage movement, that's part of its messaging, and that's very important.
You know, some opposition I've heard to that states, well, you know, the higher we make the minimum wage, the less businesses will be able to profit, or, you know, why should we make businesses pay humans any more than they're worth? But it strikes me that we're commodifying the labor force, and we're actually valuing it less than we used to, because in the 70s and 80s, you know, it was like $3 an hour, and the wages haven't kept up with inflation. What is your response to that? Where did we go wrong in terms of not keeping the line going?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you know, you can look at it historically, and to be overly simple, it's a 40-year movement whereby, as we talk about in the film and as I talk about in the book, corporate profit margins were starting to decrease. Corporations have always fought against democratic regulation. They've always fought against taxes. They've always fought against being held accountable and being held responsible for contributing their fair share for the incredible privilege that incorporation gives them. I mean, let's not forget, corporations weren't created by virtue of nature. It's a legal system that provides corporations personhood, that protects shareholders from liability, and that requires directors and managers always to act on behalf of their shareholders. So it's a state-created system that enables businesses to make huge profits, and they owe a responsibility in exchange for that. And I think we lost sight of that around the 1980s. We started to see just one side of the equation and believe that, you know, businesses had an inordinate right, a fundamental right to be free of any but the most minimal responsibilities and liabilities. And I think it was that moment that we're still living the consequences of, a view that business and corporations are ends in themselves, rather than the corporation being effectively a policy vehicle for serving the ends of society. And if we think about it in those terms, then we treat corporations a lot differently. Then profit doesn't become a right, it becomes more a privilege. It becomes an incentive to ensure that people do things, but not something that has an infinite upside and absolutely no or very few responsibilities attached to it.
Should the other end of the spectrum also play into factor? Should we have a maximum wage or a maximum allowable amount that a multinational can make in any given year?
Yeah, I mean, we already do have various kinds of approaches within our tax system that effectively set a maximum wage by clawing back a lot more proportionately once you hit a certain point as individuals. That idea for corporations, I think, would be a good one. It's been used in the past, and it is part of the reason why corporations fought back so hard beginning in the 80s to push ideas like that sort of to the margins or out of view altogether. So I think there is, you know, if we look at it from a policy perspective, which I do as a legal academic, the real question is, what do we do in exchange for providing business enterprises and business people the incredible privileges we do through incorporation? You know, what responsibilities go with those privileges? And what, from a public policy perspective, do we want to happen to the wealth that's created as a result of those privileges? And I think if we look at it in that way, we start asking very different questions than simply saying, oh, there's a business, it's, you know, created sort of by nature, not by us, and it should be able to do whatever it wants. No, I mean, being a corporation is having a license from the government to do things in a particular way.
Should we tier it to sort of maybe how socially responsible any given company is. You look at somebody like Mark Cuban, for example, who said, I'm going to pay all my work, you know, I'm going to pay all the Mavericks workers that were laid off. Or you look at somebody like Mark Benioff, when the whole, you know, thing laid down in Alabama, when Mike Pence wanted to put that, you know, the anti-LGBTQ bill, he said, all right, we're pulling out of Indiana, and he kind of forced their hand. Should we base what kind of breaks we give businesses sort of on what they do to give back to the community?
No, we should base it on law. We shouldn't leave it up to the decisions of people, as you know, good of people as they are. Benioff seems like a very decent person, and he runs Salesforce in a very decent way. And you can find many other examples. But the point of the film and the point of the book is that we shouldn't leave it to the old idea for the English, or for the European aristocracy, was an idea called noblesse oblige. And it was this idea that these nobles had a certain obligation, a moral obligation, to throw a few crumbs to the peasants, to be decent people, not to act in nasty ways to those who worked as tenant farmers on their estates. And I think it's very much what we're seeing with the Benioffs and the Cubans. It's like, okay, you know, I, Mr. Benioff or Mr. Cuban, I want to be a nice person, a good person. And so I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, and I'll decide what I'm going to do. I'm not going to give my workers any sort of real rights in terms of running the company or any cut of the profits of the company, but I'm going to decide to be a nice guy here or a nice guy there. And that's not what we need in this society. We don't need corporate leaders deciding what the right way to approach climate change is, or what the right way to approach healthcare or poverty or any of these things. The point of a democracy is the people decide those things. We decide what the balance is between corporate profit making and social good. And we decide what the rules are. That's how you and I have to run it. We don't make decisions about, you know, whether we should jaywalk or whether we shouldn't. I mean, we do, but if we do, we get caught and we get a ticket. You know, we have to comply with the law. Well, they should too.
You know, Just on this note of sort of like the people running corporations, Joe Biden, I know, is considering a few union leaders for top positions. I think he's looking at Andy Klein, I think is his name, for labor secretary, and Randy Weingarten for education secretary. Are you in favor of something like that, having more union leaders in positions of power in government?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it can hurt. I would have more environmental leaders as well. You know, I would have more leaders from sectors of society that are institutionally oriented towards serving public interests. Corporations are not. Corporations are institutionally oriented towards serving their shareholders' interests. So to me, the idea of government trying to bring more perspectives from civil society in is a very good one. It is the basis of progressive parties, traditionally, the Labour Party in Britain, the NDP in Canada, and to some extent, the Democratic Party in the United States. I mean, the main organized force for social good, for workers' good, was organized labor. And it's no surprise that force developed a political presence through parties. Now, parties like Labour and parties like the NDP have sort of broadened their civil society representation and appeal to include other social issues than just union issues, to include environmental issues, all of that. And that's kind of been the trajectory. And I think it's good that Biden is thinking along those lines as he puts together his cabinet.
What about this idea that Bill Gates talks about creative capitalism, you know, and even Brett Wilson talks about this idea of philanthropic capitalism. Where are you on a term like that?
Yeah, I mean, my view is Bill Gates should pay his taxes and let democratic institutions do the creative work that he wants to do. I mean, you know, his particular view of, say, public education is that it should be in private hands. He's been one of the main engines, and he and his money, behind privatization of schools in the United States, and as we show in the film and book, worldwide. So that is his particular sort of vision of that particular public good, is that it basically it shouldn't be public, but should be in private hands. And he uses his considerable wealth to push that vision. But who is Bill Gates accountable to? Nobody. So there's a real problem with these ideas, whether it's creative capitalism or inclusive capitalism or social capitalism or green capitalism. All these different ideas are really about how capitalism and corporations should take over the job of doing good in the world. Government should retreat. And that means, in no uncertain terms, that democracy retreats. Because no, but whatever you say about a corporation, it is not a democratic or accountable institution. And whatever you say about government, however little governments realize the ideals that constitute them, they are put together institutionally to serve the public good and to represent the public will. So this movement, whether it's creative capitalism by Bill Gates or any of these other capitalisms, towards a much greater presence of markets and corporations and a much lesser presence of public institutions, is not going in the right direction, in my view. And that's what the film and book argue.
Slightly a tangent, but I find it a bit ironic that the one thing above all else that Bill Gates seems to be criticized for is his universal vaccine idea. And, you know, people are wildly upset about that. Unfortunately we're seeing, a growing anti-vax movement, but do you see any relation in this anti-science rhetoric and societies being run by big businesses at all?
I mean, it's so complicated. The whole anti-vax thing brings to the fore that you've got these strange bedfellows of kind of, populist right-wing movements with left-wing activists coming together to rally against mask wearing or rally against vaccines or whatever. And I think what's going on there is a general distrust of government. And I think it's a legitimate distrust of government that's driving often illegitimate positions. And so people become distrustful and mistrustful of all institutions, whether it's science or it's government or it's schools, it doesn't matter. But all institutionalized power is viewed with suspicion. And anything that institutions do are then viewed with suspicion. And I think that is really unfortunate. We can't have democracy with that kind of sort of radical, each individual is an island, we should all be able to make our own decisions, because we can't put any faith at all in government and in institutions like science. And I think the blame for that has to be laid at the feet, at least in large part, of, again, big business, which has pushed for 40 years to discredit, diminish, downplay government. I mean, it has led the charge against government. It has promoted this idea that these neoliberal ideas of radical individualism, of Margaret Thatcher's, there's no such thing as society, only individuals. This has been very convenient for corporations, because it's enabled them to diminish the effects and the impacts of government on their bottom lines, pushing back taxes, pushing back regulation, pushing for more privatization. But the net result of that has been to leave the citizens with the sense that government can't be trusted, partly because government has thrown in its lot with corporations, and other partly because government has been so diminished that it doesn't really have a positive impact in people's lives that they can see anymore. And so we're in this bizarre place where our only democratic possibilities, in my view, are through kind of recapturing the institutions of democracy, including science, and making them work properly, and severing the links that they have to big business. That is the only way forward. But at the same time, we have a large swath of the population that's legitimately angry, distrustful of government because government has so diminished under the assault of corporate power. So it's a very difficult place to be.
Well, how do you reconcile that? Because you've got half of the population that, you know, hates multinationals, corporations. You have the other half that is like saying, I don't trust a word that government says because they have all my information, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, one side's over here, one side's over here. How do you bring them together?
I actually think that they're not as different. I think a lot of the people who are saying, you know, they have all our information, we can't trust them. I think that view really kind of goes across both traditional right and traditional left. I think the view that big corporations and multinational corporate interests have taken over everything is another one that straddles left and right, at least in terms of working people. I mean, in terms of, you know, sort of economic elites, I think you've also got a straddling. In other words, you have the nice capitalists, you know, like Mark Cuban, let's just say for sake of argument, and then the Koch brothers on the other side. But they both agree in terms of their class interest. They both want less government regulation. They both want fewer taxes. So I actually think when you look at it in terms of actual sort of economic interest and the views towards government, towards corporations, that you actually see a lot of possibility for bringing people together across traditional party and political lines. And I think that's why, you know, one commentator in the film, Anand Giridharadas, says, you know, everybody wants change, but whether that leads to people wanting better Medicare, or it leads to them wanting to build a wall on the southern border, is an open question. But they all want change, and a lot of them are kind of looking at the same problems as causing the situation they're in.
So do we need to keep big business and all these lobbyists out of government? Because if we do, then you'll get the right saying that's government overreach. How dare they do that? And then if we don't, you'll have, you know, the left saying, well, now businesses are running the country.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that there's probably a lot of, you know, when you look at polling, you see a lot of support for what might be called progressive positions on climate change. You see a lot of support for the proposition that nobody should be houseless, that there should be housing policies in Sherba. You see a lot of support for various kinds of robust public presence in the healthcare system, including in the United States. So if you go issue by issue, you see a lot of support, you know, 60%, 70%, even more for issues that are often associated with progressive causes. If you ask the question, should people who are very wealthy and should corporations pay the same taxes that individuals have to, you almost get like 80% of people saying yes. So policy by policy, these are the sorts of things you get. That is the place for finding bridges across these seeming divides, I think. And I don't think if you had proper safeguards against corporate money unduly influencing politics, if you had proper safeguards on lobbying, if you had programs that, as we were discussing, brought other kinds of voices into government influence positions, environmental groups, social groups, unions, others, I actually don't think you'll get a lot of pushback from ordinary people. You'll definitely get a lot of pushback from the Jamie Dimons of the world and the Business Roundtable, and they'll be screaming about how this is violating freedom of speech and violating personal liberty and all of that. But I think that their views tend to be overamplified and tend to be underrepresentative of the views of most of the population, including those who in the United States vote Republican and those in other countries who are on the right side of the spectrum.
Do we need to get, you know, the millionaires out of politics? Because if you look at the 2016 election, I think, you know, half of the Republican candidates had a substantial amount of money to give to their campaigns. And then you have someone like Andrew Yang, who ran in this last election, who's a businessman, but is saying, you know, hey, I want this federal minimum wage. Where are you in terms of, you know, I guess the businessmen who actually run for office, and should there be a limit on how much they can spend on their own campaigns?
I think we need limits on campaign spending, period. I mean, we have them in Canada, and I think they work fairly effectively in Canada. In the United States, as a result of some Supreme Court decisions, Citizens United and others, they've been profoundly whittled down. In terms of, you know, I don't think it matters whether you're a billionaire that's running for politics or you're a 100,000-aire who has a billionaire behind you and you're running for politics. I don't think that matters much. I think the issue isn't a personal one, it's a structural one. And it's a structural one whereby people are able to spend a lot of money funding a campaign for a particular politician and then show up after that politician wins and say, what's my payback? That's just human nature. That's the way things work. And that's the way things are currently working more in Washington and US state capitals than in other countries, which do have better, not perfect, but better limits. And I also think we really have to take seriously the lobbying piece, not just the campaign financing piece. In Canada, the United States, there are, you know, really minuscule limits on lobbying. Our campaign funding limits are much more robust than any kind of regulation of lobbying. And to me, that just feels like, I mean, it's not controversial that there should be laws in place that set certain kinds of standards about how different groups can interface with government. You know, the whole purpose in a democracy is for government to represent the will of the people, and obviously undue influence from any group is going to be a problem, especially from groups who have a lot of money to exert undue influence.
It strikes me, though, you know, just from what I've been reading online, that a lot of people are maybe a little more government illiterate. You know, they say the fact that, like, you know, how dare the federal government do this, this, and this, without realizing, well, that's actually the provincial government that puts those regulations in, or, you know, or even in some cases, municipal or regional governments, right? You know, or especially, you know, when it comes to COVID regulations and, you know, the shuttering of businesses and all the different aspects that go with that. So how do we get our society back to being more politically literate?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And as an educator, you know, I'm appalled at I teach in a law school, and many of my students come into a law school, and these are students who have done 4 years in an undergraduate program and are very bright to get into a law school, and still are fairly ignorant about how our system of government works, about the basic ideas about federalism and about whether a province or the federal government has jurisdiction over a matter, and what is the role of cities, and what about indigenous governments, and how do they fit into all of that? And so it seems fairly obvious and unoriginal to say, why the hell don't we teach this stuff in elementary school? Why don't we teach it in high school? Like, why do we have a system that is premised on citizens governing themselves by electing people to represent them, but we never really teach about it? I mean, some teachers do and some schools do, and, you know, but that isn't seen as a core competency, citizenship as a core competency, understanding the basic dimensions of the governing system that you're a part of, and understanding that you have responsibilities to be a part of it, not just rights in relation to it. So, I don't really have a better answer than to say, we need to have a very well-funded and well-resourced public education system to begin with. And I feel that we're further ahead in this country than in the United States, for example. But we also need to, you know, if we're going to be teaching the three R's as basic competencies, I've never understood this because they're all spelled wrong, but reading, except for reading, writing, and arithmetic. Why don't we add another R in there, which is responsible citizenship?
I remember when I took my political science class, my teacher was saying something like 60% of Canadians wouldn't pass the citizenship test right. if they took it. And, you know, because I think it's 20 questions and I think you have to get, I think it's 16 or something like that. What does that say? Does that say that our citizenship test is too hard or that we don't have enough knowledge about our own country?
I haven't seen the most recent citizenship test, so I can't really comment on it. But I doubt it's too hard. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, there are different ways as an educator, again, there are different ways to teach about citizenship. I don't think it matters if people know exactly how many seats are in the provincial legislature. So there are a lot of dry facts about our system that that if I were teaching a group of grade 7 or grade 8 kids about Canadian democracy, that wouldn't be my starting point. My starting point would be more about, you know, we live in a country where we try to divide up responsibilities for government between Indigenous governments, between cities and provinces and federal. And why do we do that? What's the reason for, you know, to think about those kind of more interesting, I guess, philosophical issues. And so I'm not sure what the citizenship test tests, but if it is those kind of dry facts, then I would say it doesn't worry me that people don't know those dry facts. It worries me that they don't have a kind of working sense of the broader architecture of our system. Where does the Charter of Rights fit in? You know, what? Why do we even care about democracy? What is democracy a solution to in terms of what's the problem that democracy is trying to solve? And what happens when we lose it? Yeah. You know, those kind of things, I think, are how we need to attack it.
You've mentioned Indigenous governments a couple of times, and you know this has been an ever increasing discussion over the last few years, especially, you know, out here in BC with the pipeline. You know, there was something like I think 24 Indigenous leaders said they were in favor, but many, you know, were opposed to that until the you know the government bought it out and the board said unilaterally yes you can go ahead. What you know, any time. We pass, you know, a project passes through a traditional territory. How much approval should the federal government get from Indigenous communities, and what type of dialogue needs to happen before going through with anything?
Yeah, it's a great question, a very complicated question, because there are constitutional obligations on the Crown, on the government, under Section 35(1) of the Constitution Act of 1982 that require a certain level of consultation, that require a level of dialogue, that require even a level of approaching approval. But those are all big questions at the moment. That are still sort of working their way through the courts. There are some you know, useful leading decisions from the Supreme Court of Canada on the broad parameters. But what exactly that means in a given context is still being worked out. And I guess I would say two things about that. One is there's the constitutional question about what's required, but then there's the broader political slash ethical question about what should be done. And I think that there's kind of an evolving sensibility around different areas, around governance. What does true governance by Indigenous communities over their own affairs mean? What does that require? What does consultation mean once you've established what that means? And to what extent does consultation merge into approval? If, you know, once you accept that indigenous governments have a degree of sovereignty over their territories, doesn't that mean that they should have the right to approve or not to approve? And how do we solve the problem that we have, you know, band council chiefs that are set up under the Indian Act, a colonialist instrument that was actually the seen as part of the model and inspiration for South African apartheid, an interesting little corner in our history. So we have the Indian Act chiefs, and then we have the hereditary chiefs. And so the whole question of who gets to decide is a major question. And then there are problems of indigenous communities and members of the indigenous communities who are not living in those communities, but living in urban centers, for example. So what are their rights as citizens of those communities? So it's an incredibly complex issue, and it's being worked out. But I think, you know, from my own perspective, the bottom line is that, especially in BC, where we don't have treaties for the most part, the land was never ceded. The indigenous communities that live on that land and that have used that land from time immemorial have jurisdiction over it. I would say a measure of sovereignty over it should be seen, and increasingly are seen, as another order of government in Canada, along with provinces and the federal government, a third order of government, as it's often described, as being part of the federal system rather than subject to the federal system. And so all of that is kind of playing out. But from my own sort of personal view, I think those communities should have a say, should be able to approve. And there should be processes in place for that to happen. You know, it's obviously very complicated, but as a sort of starting principle, it seems to me that that is the right principle, that sovereignty by indigenous governments over territories means that there's a right to be involved in approval.
You know, we've seen several indigenous people, you know, in public office. Romeo Saganash, Elijah Harper comes to mind. And, you know, Jagmeet Singh obviously is a visible minority, and we're seeing a lot more women in cabinet these days, and younger people. How do you think Canada is doing on representation and diversity in this country?
Well, in my own little bailiwick, I mean, we did have an opportunity recently to appoint an Indigenous person to the Supreme Court of Canada, and we didn't do it. You know, and I found that disappointing. I mean, the person who was appointed, Sheila Martin, is a superb and superbly qualified jurist. I don't take anything away from her at all, but I do think that we missed an opportunity there. Then, you know, there are the very complicated questions of tokenism. There are the very complicated questions of if individuals are parts of larger political parties like the Liberals or the Conservatives or even the NDP, how is that going to really change things? Jody Wilson is an excellent example, who she really took a very strong stand and was a very forceful Minister of Justice. But still, even while she was Minister of Justice, one can't say that we made, you know, leaps and bound progress on the issues of justice for Indigenous people. So, you know, we really need to think about a lot of these problems as problems that require collective kinds of approaches to solving. And while I think it's very important from certainly a symbolic and a material perspective to ensure that there is representation in our democratic institutions, I also think that that is not a substitute for recognizing the collective rights and the collective claims of the various groups that are being represented. And I think too often that equation is made that, you know, as long as we have representation in our dominant institutions, then all will be well. And that is not the point at all. The point is that those institutions are dominant and that other groups, collective groups like Indigenous people and others need to have their concerns addressed, not at just the individual level.
You know, just sort of bridging back to the film here, we were talking about this idea of social responsibility. And one thing a lot of the rich people have done is the giving pledge. People like, you know, Buffett and Gates pledging to donate something like 99% of their wealth. I see it's a good thing, but I also see it as problematic because you don't necessarily know where that wealth is going, like the money is going to end up per se. Where are you on that concept?
Look, money is power. There's no question. And money pushes some policies and diminishes others. And so if Bill Gates is deciding where that, you know, 99% of his wealth goes, I think that's a problem because I don't agree with Bill Gates. I don't agree with his views on education. A lot of his money goes into the privatization cause, as I mentioned earlier. And so I would rather that he did something else with that 99% than fueled a movement that I don't think is good for society, that is pushing for more privatized education. And that's just one example. You can magnify that a million times by the million billionaires or 100,000 or whomever, probably not a million, but however many, whoever they are, who are making these giving pledges. They decide in accordance with their own ideologies, with their own perspectives, with their own views, with no accountability to anybody. They decide what they're going to support and how they're going to support it. And typically, that is not a decision that's going to line up with a strong sense of social governance. It's going to line up typically with a stronger sense of private governance, of more power to philanthropic institutions, to foundations, to other billionaires, to various private projects, to social entrepreneurship, but not to creating a more robust public sector. And then there's the question of how the hell they got that money in the first place. And a lot of the reason they accumulate the wealth they do is because they pay no taxes. They don't give the money to democratically representative institutions to decide how to spend that money. And so in place of that, they decide how to spend that money. So I think it's highly, highly problematic. The first question to ask is, why should they have that amount of money in the first place? And the second question to ask is, why is it a good thing that they're using it to push their view of what the world should look like?
Do we need to then dismantle the entire capitalist system? And if so, what would that look like?
You know, I think that we often confuse the idea of capitalism with the idea of markets. And what I mean by that is that when we think of capitalism, the very fact that we attach an ism to the word capital suggests that capital is the primary goal. And to me, that's where the problem starts. The idea is that pursuing, increasing, producing capital should be what all of society is about, and that then some of that will trickle down through Bill Gates, you know, giving pledge or however else, or through jobs that are created, it'll trickle down to everybody else and create a decent society. So that, to me, that's problematic. I think once you accept capitalism as the right term, you've kind of given credence to the idea that accumulating capital is the ultimate telos, the ultimate goal of a society. So I prefer to talk about a society being democratic with markets. I'm not against markets. I'm not even against corporations. I just think they need to be kept in their lane. And I think that lane is one that says, how can we best sort of create an alchemical mix between and among public institutions, democratic governance institutions, markets, private businesses, publicly traded corporations, privately held corporations? What is the best mix that's going to serve the ultimate needs of our collective needs as a society, of equality, of social solidarity, of air that we can breathe, of a climate that isn't deteriorating. And let's go for that. I'm not in favor of dismantling everything. I think markets have their place. I don't want my coffee cup to be made by the government. I'm not in favor of sort of, you know, Soviet style socialism. Markets have their place, and private business has its place. You know, we need both a thriving public sector and a thriving private sector to make democratic work, democracy work. And we need individuals to have freedom, but we also need them to have responsibilities. It's very, very complicated. What has happened over the last 40 years is it's been simplified. And it's been simplified into the idea that we actually don't need a robust public sector. We just need a robust private sector. We just need corporations to be as free as possible. And if they're free, we'll all be free. And if they don't pay taxes, then we won't pay taxes. And wow, there's a utopian vision where government is just shunted to the sidelines. Corporations are running everything. And now more recently, they're telling us they're good and they can do it. And we should rely on them to run our schools and our water systems. And, you know, let's just have a world that's run in accordance with private imperatives and private freedoms and all of that. To me, that's ridiculous. So what we have to do is go back to the idea that it's a lot more complicated than that, that there is a place for a robust public sector and for robust democratic governance, and try to figure out how to make all those ingredients work.
What do you want ultimately people to take away from the film when they watch it?
What I just said, you know, I want them to take away the idea that we've gone down a road over the last 40 years that has, especially in the United States, resulted in the last 4 years, and that there are people who see that and who are trying to change it. That the hopeful note is that nobody is giving up. And in fact, people are pushing even harder. They're saying enough is enough. The Black Lives Matter protests, the climate protests, the various instances of progressive politicians that we look at in the film, there is a way forward. And it's a question of finding it and finding the sort of political will and political synergy to get there. And I the last thing I want people to take away from the film is that this is about good guys and bad guys. This is more about these sort of ideological notions that get nested in our brains and the structures that those enable. And so what I want the film and the book to do is to at least cause people to question those and to think about what that means for moving forward.
Well, the film is The New Corporation, co-directed by you and Jennifer Abbott. It is out now. Joel Bakken, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Cheers. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Once again, that was my conversation with law professor, writer, and filmmaker Joel Bakken. He is the co-director of the new film, The New Corporation, the unfortunately necessary sequel, which, as you might have guessed, is a sequel to his 2003 hit documentary, The Corporation. The New Corporation is out now. That does it for me today. On Thursday, we'll have another documentarian. This time, we're talking about Christmas, and specifically Santa. And I talked to Dana Nachman about her documentary, Letters to Santa. That's coming up on Thursday. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Goodbye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.